Remember, we are currently studying how harmonic oscillators can get excited. Yes? Okay, sure. But it's already online, freely available.
It's just a blog.
Okay, that's fine. Sure. So we're studying how harmonic oscillators can get excited. And we do that very carefully, because later on, this is happening in the context of harmonic oscillators that describe modes of quantum fields in curved space. So we isolate the curved space difficulties from the general harmonic oscillator issues. So first we study the harmonic oscillator very carefully so that those concepts become familiar, and then we can focus on the curvature part when we do quantum field theory on curved space. So what we do here is we'll apply for all harmonic oscillators, including those of fields, quantum fields. Remember that there are two basic mechanisms to describe how one can increase the excitation level of a harmonic oscillator. We can either have a time-varying driving force, or we can vary some parameter of the harmonic oscillator so that the oscillation frequency changes. That too can excite the harmonic oscillator. And remember that a classical harmonic oscillator could not be excited parametrically from the ground state. Quantum harmonic oscillators can be, as we will see. We are currently in the middle of considering the case A, exciting harmonic oscillators through an external driving force. And here's the Hamiltonian for that situation. It's p squared, the potential term, and then here's the driving force. In the case of quantum fields, this would be the field amplitude, and this could be an external charge and current field. For example, the charges and currents in an antenna would drive the amplitudes of the modes of the electromagnetic field. We will do that in much more detail, by the way, next week on Thursday. We will study exactly how a system like an atom can emit a photon, how it can absorb a photon. There is induced emission. And in particular, we will see what happens when the atom is accelerated. Because that effect that then occurs, the so-called Unruh effect, is a very close relative to the Hawking effect of Hawking radiation, where the only difference is really that in the case of the Hawking effect, it's curvature, and in the case of the Unruh effect, it's acceleration that makes the effect, but by the equivalence principle, they're almost the same. So we were considering case A, external driving force, and in particular, the case where the driving force is acting only in a finite time interval, namely from time equal 0 to time equal capital T. And our strategy that we developed at the end of the last lecture was that we will not so much care about what exactly is going on while the driving happens, but instead we will compare the before and the after. We will study what the system's parameters are before the driving happened, and then what are the properties of the system after the driving happened. This has several reasons. We will see three things eventually coming out of this analysis. We can describe in this case what happened in the very early universe cosmology. We may not be interested in exactly what the details are of the expansion, but we need to find out how an initial state of the quantum field, such as the vacuum state, evolved into a later state after the bulk of the acceleration of the universe is over. In the case of a black hole, we have some vacuum, let's say, before. Then the star collapses, supernova, and afterwards we have a black hole with Hawking radiation. We're not really interested so much in the details of the supernova here. We just want to know, how does the black hole look like, and how does it arise from the vacuum that we had before? By the way, did you hear that yesterday or the day before yesterday, a huge supernova went off in a nearby galaxy? Big deal, biggest since a quarter century or so. And it was discovered by students because the professionals who were looking for them had an overflow of data. Basically, it looked too bright to the instruments that saw it. So the big telescope saw the supernova, but they didn't believe that it was a supernova because it was too bright. Can you imagine? But it's still going on. And actually, if you know where to look, you should be able to see it in the night sky, just like that. It's so bright. It's brighter than the entire galaxy. See, we can only see one galaxy with our own naked eyes other than our own galaxy. And that's Andromeda. But this is Messier 82 or something. We wouldn't be able to see that. But apparently, the supernova in it, we can see. But only for a few days. All right, so back to the harmonic oscillator. In order to study its time evolution, we could study the equation of motion for P, the equation of motion for Q, as usual. But instead, we will pursue a trick that will be useful in several respects. Namely, we combine the Q and the P as the real and the imaginary part of one variable A. If we find out what the time evolution of A is, we can quickly recover what the time evolution of Q is. We just take the real part of it, or more precisely, the self-adjoint part of it. And if we want to know what the time evolution of P is, we just take the imaginary or the anti-self-adjoint part of it. We have so far not yet cared about how to build a Hilbert space representation of these things. So we're just formally doing a time evolution. But we will get to this. We will start this today, the Hilbert space representation of those operator-valued functions. So this was a convenient variable to choose. And we chose our prefactors here very cleverly. See, the real part with the prefactor, and P is the imaginary part with the prefactor, or the anti-self-adjoint part with the prefactor. And we chose the prefactor in such a way that the commutation relations will come out very simple, and of the A and the A dagger, and also such that the Hamiltonian is also as simple as it gets. If we chose different coefficients here, then this wouldn't be simply A dagger A, but instead you would also have A dagger squared terms and A squared terms. And here you recognize the driving force term. This was the Q, right? Q with 1 over square root of 2 omega. Now, now that we have everything expressed in terms of the simpler variable A, we have to solve only one equation of motion instead of those equations of motion for Q and that for P. We just solve that for A. And the Heisenberg equation of motion for A is I times A dot equal to the commutator of A with H. And we worked out that it is this, which is a very simple equation of motion. If the driving force term were absent, and at early times, remember, we say that J is equal to 0. And at late times, J is 0, too. If the driving, whenever the driving force term is absent, we simply have that IA dot is omega A, which tells us right away what the solution is. It's going to be that A of T is A of T naught, is A at a fixed time, multiplied with a phase factor, right? Because if it's a phase factor, then we just differentiate that. We get down the I omega, and that would be easy. OK, so we have to solve the equation of motion, which in the absence of a driving force is simply the original A at the initial time multiplied with a phase factor of e to the power of minus I omega t. We will also have to make sure that the canonical commutation relations hold. And that's the only thing that will enforce that we have operator valued functions of time. Other than that, we could do that trick also in classical mechanics, where we just take a linear combination of Q and P and get an A, and then everything is just number value. We actually found a solution to this thing explicitly. We give the initial condition a name. We call whatever the operator A is at the initial point in time, we call A in. So at some early time, before the force was acting, our operator A at time t equals 0 was some operator in Hilbert space, and we give it the name A in. Then the operator A at a later time, starting with this initial condition and then evolving according to that, is this one. Remember, in the absence of a driving force, this is simply the defining differential equation for an exponential. And indeed, in the absence of a driving force, you see when j is equal to 0, that whole thing is gone. Then we have that a of t is the initial a multiplied with this phase factor, which guarantees that if you differentiate it with respect to time, you get down to minus I omega, and that's what you should get, and that's it. If there is a driving force, then there's an additional term, and it is this. I hope you've all verified that since Tuesday. And an important thing to notice about that expression here is that it is multiplied with the identity operator. See, this can't just be a number, because here we have an operator in Hilbert space. We can't add an operator to a Hilbert on a Hilbert space to a number. No, this is a number times the identity. So if, let's say, you write this as a matrix, then this will be the identity matrix. Okay, so that's the structure of the solution. That is the solution, and we just discussed the structure of it. Now, a proposition is that we can solve the remaining equation, namely that the canonical commutation relations hold at all time, easily, very easily, if only we make sure that it holds at the initial time. So the claim is that if we find an operator in Hilbert space which obeys these initial conditions, which at the initial time, if the operator A in at the initial time obeys the canonical commutation relations, then this operator here, which is now time dependent, will obey the canonical commutation relations at all times. There are two ways to check that. I'll give you one way, and I'll invite you to check another way. Namely, here's the proof. Assume that whatever the operator is of A at the initial time, it obeys the canonical commutation relations. Later, of course, we will make sure of this by construction. We will make a Fock space construction. We will consider the vector, which is mapped onto 0, onto the 0 vector, the 0 length vector, when A in is acting on it. And then we will generate, with this as a ladder operator, lots of other vectors in the Hilbert space. And in this way, we get a Fock basis. And in this Fock basis, the A in will be a ladder operator that goes down the ladder, and the A dagger will be a ladder operator that goes up the ladder. And as one can easily verify, the commutation relations are obeyed. In fact, by construction, this is the way we do it. I'm hoping that you've all seen that in quantum mechanics, but we will also do it. Yes?
So this J, we're considering J to be like a scalar function.
Yes. But it is a real valued function of time.
Yeah, but to use this as like, because J and Q are going to be like interaction between different fields, right? So why don't we consider J to be like a field, some grade?
Yes. In principle, you could consider J to be operator valued. It would make things more complicated, though. And for the purposes that we need here, we don't need to go to that level of complication. Of course, in principle, all degrees of freedom are quantum. But for example, if you want to understand how an antenna emits photons, you don't really need the quantum theory of the electrons. You can study just the classical current classical charges and how they move, and from that you can calculate how the antenna is actually producing photons. So there are circumstances when you need to consider the quantum theory of the J. For example, the J might be another quantum field, right, as we discussed earlier. But in many circumstances, the expectation value of J will be much larger than the fluctuations in J, delta J, the uncertainty in J. And in that case, and that's the case we assume here, you can just drop that because the fluctuations of J are going to be small, and the dominant part is the time evolution of the expectation value. In fact, towards at the end of today's lecture, we will go pretty deeply into the classical quantum transition there. Okay, so here's one way to prove that if the canonical commutation relations are obeyed initially, if we've properly constructed our operators such that they commute in this way, then automatically, because of the equations of motion, the A of t that we get from that formula here, the A of t and its Hermitian conjugate, A dagger of t, will obey the canonical commutation relations at all times. So here's how we show that. We just plug it in. A of t, A dagger of t, commutator. This is A of t. Notice that there's a minus sign. There's A dagger of t, which is almost the same, but there's a dagger here, and there's a plus sign because the whole thing is Hermitian conjugated. And, oh yeah, I should have indicated this is a plus here, that's a minus there, but it doesn't make a difference because those guys, this thing is multiplied with the identity operator, which commutes with everything. And that thing is multiplied with the identity operator, which commutes with everything. See, there's no operator in there, just numbers. So in the commutator, these guys just completely drop out. And we are left with just the commutator of this with that, where the e to the minus I omega t is there, and the e to the plus I omega t also makes it down there. But of course, they just annihilate each other. And then we are left with finding that the commutator between A of t and A dagger of t is the same as the commutator of A and A dagger, which we know is 1 by construction. So that's one way of checking that the commutation relations, if obeyed at one time, will be obeyed forever. Another way to check that, which is much more powerful, and I invite you to check for that, is that you can prove, let me just put the proposition out there, that if two operators have some commutation relations, arbitrary one, at one point in time, then under time evolution cannot change. And that's if the time evolution is unitary. The time evolution is unitary, commutation relations cannot change. It's because each operator has, under time evolution, a u dagger from the left and a u from the right, where u is the time evolution operator. And so when you have the product of operators, well, then you have that the u daggers eat up the u's, and you just get an overall u dagger on the left and overall u dagger on the right. You see how the proof goes, right? So in practice, we don't really have to do this for each case of dynamics. As long as the dynamics is unitary, we know that the commutation relations are going to be preserved. Later, in the case of quantum field theory, we will find another way of looking at this, which is this statement that the commutation relations are preserved in time will translate into a statement for the solutions of differential equations. The differential equations simply have no other choice because we set the overall framework such that it's unitary time evolution which preserves the commutation relation. And so that it will turn out that the conservation of the commutation relations implies that the so-called Wronskian of solutions of differential equations is conserved in time. I'm just saying that in case you've encountered the so-called Wronskian before. So let us look closer at the structure of the solution. Our solution can be written in this form. It's the same solution that we had before. I've just pulled this factor out of the two terms here. See, this factor was in here, and that phase factor was also in there. I've just pulled it up. this is another way you can write the solution. Now, remember, we assume that the force is acting only on a finite time interval, from time t equals 0 to time capital T. Outside that time interval, the force is vanishing. That means that it, at early times, before the force has had a chance to act, this term is absent, and our A of t is simply A in times this phase, as we discussed earlier. The differential equation is just that of an exponential, and so there's no surprise. While the driving force is acting, this term is actively changing. You know, there's t dependence in this over there. And that thing keeps rotating, of course, so there's some action. It's a little bit non-trivial. And I just wrote here that A of t, during the time when the force is acting, those middle times, during that time, the A of t is given by this whole expression here. At late times, things are simple again. Because at late times, this term is no longer time dependent. Yeah, that thing is time dependent still, but this term is no longer, because this is an integration dummy variable, t prime, and we are integrating up to the value t. In principle, therefore, that integral should change as the time changes, right? A of t for later t is a larger integration. But no, once we are past capital T, once we are at late times and the force is no longer acting, we can simply write here that we integrate from 0 to capital T. Because for later times, the integral has no contribution. The j is vanishing. Right? So this is just at late times, this is only the integral from 0 to capital T. Yeah, it's really the integral also to small t, but there is nothing between capital T and small t, because the force is vanishing for those late times. Therefore, this whole thing is just a number that doesn't change anymore at late times. And that number we gave a name. We called it j naught. J naught is the integral from 0 to t, which is the maximum number, which is the final number that this integral, this the final value that this integral takes when the force is finished acting. And then that value doesn't change anymore. So at late times, after the force has stopped acting, our solution looks like this. It's a in plus identity operator times a fixed number, closing the bracket, and this thing. That's what's written here. It's a in plus j naught. I should really write here the identity operator, but I guess you see that this is implied. And then multiplied with e to the minus I omega t. This may all look a little tedious now, but remember that this is how you calculate Hawking radiation. This is how you calculate inflationary cosmology and so on. This is just the simplest case where all of this stuff arises. So what we see is that the A at late times is just a sort of shifted version of A in up to this phase factor. And later we will give that thing a name just because it plays the role of the A in earlier at late time, so we will call this A out. Okay, so we saw that the system is a simple undriven harmonic oscillator early, and it is a simple undriven harmonic oscillator late. And we focus attention on just those two periods, the early one, the late one. And by defining what we just said, that the A in plus J naught is A out, calling this thing A out, we can say that the solution is given by A in at this time, at early times, and it's given by A out times this phase factor at late times, where the A out is nothing mysterious, it's just the A in plus J. And we don't worry about the intermediate times for now. I leave it to you as an exercise to verify that the commutator between a out and a dagger out is 1, even though some of you will probably already see why that's the case. You see why that's the case? Why a out commutes with a dagger out in the same way that a in does? Any guesses? Yeah, it's just a scalar add. It's just a constant times the identity added. And that j is not going to mess things up, right? If you write here a in plus j and here a in dagger plus j star, you know, the j's commute with everything. There's just a ins left over, and we know that the a in commutator is 1. Okay. That's going to be useful because just the way that we are going to build a FOC basis for using the a in to get a convenient basis of the Hilbert space, we can also use the a out and a out dagger operators to build a basis of the same Hilbert space. The FOC basis that we will build with the a in states will be convenient to describe the physics of the early stages before the force act, and the basis of the Hilbert space that we obtain by using those guys as ladder operators will be a convenient basis to describe what goes on late. And in particular, this relationship between A in and A out, this one, will provide the crucial link between the in and the out. Let's look at the initial time period to start with. We have as the dynamical variables we have a of t, and that we know gives us everything, all information. We can calculate from a of t through itself a joint part what q of t is, and through its anti-self adjoint part what p of t is, and we also get the h, because h is expressed in q and p. So concretely, we have that the q of t is given by this expression here, and if you don't believe it, please check it. Just a sec. Okay. So here's the q of t. Here is p of t, and the Hamiltonian is given in this way. We constructed it in this way. Remember, this is why we chose the prefactors alpha and beta in the description of A in terms of q and p, such that the commutation relations become simple and such that the Hamiltonian becomes simple, and that's what we have here. So in particular, the Hamiltonian now, we can express explicitly because we have the solution in terms of A in. Now, at early times, A of t is simply A in times this phase factor, right? Remember, over here, at early times, A of t is A in times the phase factor. At late times, it's A out times the phase factor. So at early times, we have that the Hamiltonian, which is expressed generally in terms of the A of t, is concretely expressed in terms of the A dagger in and A in this way, where, notice, that we have the product between A dagger and A, which means that we have A dagger, and then we have the phase factor with 1 sign, and A in, A dagger in, and A in, and here with the phase factor with the opposite sign, so that those two guys go away, which means that the Hamiltonian becomes this for all early time. And we can read off from this that the Hamiltonian is a constant operator. We're working in the Heisenberg picture. Only operators have a chance to evolve in time. States are fixed. And this Hamiltonian is not changing in time. It's just a constant operator. Whatever the A in is, as a matrix acting on our Hilbert space, or as an operator acting on our Hilbert space, it allows us to write down the Hamiltonian at all early times. So everything about the energy is constant. Now, let's construct the Hilbert space in a convenient way. And in particular, we will construct it by constructing a basis that will span it. Once we have a basis, any linear combination of that will be Hilbert space vector, and that's how we build up the entire space. We could, in order to generate a basis of a Hilbert space, diagonalize any self-adjoint operator we like. There is the so-called spectral theorem, which tells us that for any self-adjoint operator, there is a way to construct a basis. Well, strictly speaking, the spectrum has to be discrete so that you have proper eigenvectors. But even when the spectrum is continuous, there is an analogon to constructing a basis, you know, as in the case of the momentum operator, as in the case of the position operator. The position eigenvectors are not normalizable. Momentum eigenvectors are not normalizable, so they're not strictly speaking the Hilbert space, but you know that we can actually span the Hilbert space using them. The trick is to always integrate. For example, if you want to know what's the probability for finding a particle at a point, then you have to calculate for a given state psi what the bracket is with a position eigenvector. And that doesn't give you the probability, because the probability for finding a particle at a point is always zero. The probability for finding the particle in an interval, that can be finite. Right? And that's how the spectral theorem operates. In any case, my point is we could generate a proper or improper basis of our Hilbert space by using any observable, such as Q, using Q eigenbasis, or P, using a P eigenbasis. But in this case here, it will be very convenient to use the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian operator is self-adjoint. It's going to have an eigenbasis, and it has lots of advantages. One of them is that the spectrum of the Hamilton operator for a harmonic oscillator is discrete. So its eigenvectors are actually Hilbert space vectors, and we don't need to worry about any complications. And secondly, the Hamiltonian is a constant operator, as we just determined, which means that at all early times, it's the same basis. The Hamilton operator doesn't change at early times before the force acts, and so its eigenbasis also doesn't change. The momentum and position operators are still time dependent, so, you know, their basis vectors could change. So let's calculate the eigenbasis of, or construct an eigenbasis of the eigenbasis of the Hamilton operator for early times. At early times, and I'm writing this as h hat t smaller 0, no, at time t equals 0, the force starts acting. We have that at early times, the Hamilton operator is this constant operator here, where the A in and the A out obey these commutation relations. This much we know. And now we start the usual Fock construction. Is everybody familiar with this, by the way? Who's not familiar with Fock constructions? Oh, quite a few of you. All right, okay, so ask if anything is unclear about this. So let us assume that there exists a vector in the Hilbert space which we are about to construct. I mean, we are about to construct a Hilbert space. Let's assume that there's a vector which we will call 0 in, which has the property that when we apply A in on it, that vector is mapped onto the zero length vector in the Hilbert space. Okay, so this is the zero vector in the Hilbert space, in the sense that you can add that vector to any vector in the Hilbert space. You don't change its length, because this thing has length 0. It's a neutral element in the vector space regarding addition. Let's assume there's such a vector, and then let's see what its properties are. And we will find that, we know those properties. We recognize that. And then we will be able to identify that vector in the Hilbert space, going back to what else we know about quantum harmonic oscillators. So if there is such a state in the Hilbert space, which is, as we say, annihilated by the A operator, then as a consequence, it will be an eigenvector of our Hamiltonian at early times. How do we see that? Well, we apply the Hamiltonian at early times, that's why we have the subscript t smaller 0, onto that vector, of which we know only one thing. It is annihilated by the an. And of course, we will also normalize it to length 1. But for now, all we know is that it's an eigenvector to eigenvalue 0 of this operator. Then we apply this Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is this. So from here to there, I'm only spelling out what the Hamiltonian is. Then we have a 1 omega half applied to this. And we have a dagger a applied to this. But the a acting on that vector here is killing it, right? Because this is an eigenvector to eigenvalue 0 of a. So no matter what the a dagger does, the a is already killing that vector. So we are left with simply the action of omega half on this vector. And that's what we get, which means that this vector here is indeed an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian. See, Hamiltonian acting on this is given by 1 half h bar omega, if we still bothered writing the h bar, 1 half h bar omega times that. Well, we know that the harmonic oscillator has a state like that. It's the ground state. Now, and it has only one of them, right? It's unique. Now, let's look at, wait a moment. Yes. Now, let's look at this state, which we obtain not by applying A on that vector, on the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, but we apply a dagger on it. Well, we give it a name. We call it 1-in. Instead of 0-in, it's 1-in now. And the reason why that is justified, call it 1, or why that is a good name, will come up in the next calculation. Let us apply the Hamilton operator, the energy operator, on that 1-in state. All we know about that state is that it is given by a dagger acting on that. And of course, we know the commutation relations of a dagger n. It turns out that's all we need to find out what this state really is. So we apply the Hamiltonian on that. So we, which is to say, we apply the Hamiltonian at early times onto a dagger in this. I'm just spelling out what that vector was. It's 1-in, which is by definition a dagger in on that vector. And now I'm spelling out what the Hamiltonian is. It's this thing, acting on that. So let's work out what this whole thing gives us if we apply that whole thing onto that vector 0 in. So there are two terms. We have a term omega half a dagger in. That term you can see here. Omega half a dagger in applied to that vector 0 in. We also get another term, which is omega a dagger in a dagger in applied to that. I didn't write that term down here. Let me just reiterate what the term is. It's omega a dagger. The a dagger part I wrote as a dagger a plus 1. Okay, that's legal because a dagger minus a dagger a is 1. In other words, a dagger is a dagger a plus 1. I just used the commutation relations. So the term omega a dagger is really the term omega a dagger times this. Because that's the same as a dagger. Now, why did we do that? We did that because by flipping around the sequence of a dagger and a, by having the A act on the right. And that's going to be a trick that you will see a million times. By having the A act on the right, we will have the A act on this, where it's going to be eaten up, right? Because this is eigenvector to A with eigenvalue 0. So this term drops out. And we are left only with omega A dagger times 1 plus omega half A dagger applied to this. And that is omega 3 half A dagger 0 in. And A dagger 0 in is, by definition, the vector 1. So what we see is that this vector is indeed eigenvector as well of the Hamiltonian, but now with energy 3 half h bar omega. We recognize that vector. Harmonic oscillators have one such vector, and that's the first excited state. So the state 1 in is eigenstate of the Hamiltonian with this energy, must be the first excited state. Let's see. Is this vector normalized? Remember, the vector 0 in, we chose to be normalized, right? I mean, we said that once we confirm its existence, we will normalize it. So this is a vector of length 1. Now, let's see. Let's verify whether that vector is normalized. You see, we no longer have a choice in this, because this vector is constructed, not chosen, right? It's constructed in this way. Now let's see whether this vector is normalized, assuming that that one is. So we have here the norm of the vector 1 in. Let's spell out what the vector 1 in is. It is A dagger in applied to the vector 0. And if this is the ket, then the bra to that is a 0 with an A, Hermitian conjugate, right? Usual Dirac notation thing. And what we have here is an A dagger acting to the right and an A to the left. Not as useful as if it were the other way around. Let's turn them around. We know from the commutation relations that A dagger is the same as A dagger A plus 1. So that's what we do. We use the commutation relations to write this as A dagger A plus 1. And now we have the A acting on the right, on this one. But this is eigenvector to eigenvalue 0 of that. So therefore, that term goes away. And we simply have the norm of this vector. So we conclude that if this vector, the 0, the ground state vector, started out normalized, this will propagate. And that is normalized as well. Here's a proposition. And if you're not familiar with the Fock state construction, Fock basis construction, then please prove it as an exercise. We can define a set of vectors that we will call n in. And n ranges from 0 to infinity. The case n equals 0, we covered already. The case n equals 1, we covered already. And this just continues it to any positive integer n. We define those operator. We define those vectors as the vectors that you obtain by applying A dagger n times onto the vector 0, onto the ground state vector of the harmonic oscillator. And you divide by 1 over square root of n factorial. It turns out that that factor is needed in order to make sure that this thing is normalized. See, if n is equal to 0, 0 factorial is 1. If n is equal to 1, we have 1 factorial, which is 1. That's why we didn't notice that there actually is a factor needed to get normalization. So the proposition is that these vectors are orthonormal. They are both orthogonal and normalized. And you can prove that by just calculating what the inner product is between one of those vectors and another one of those vectors. Let's say n in and m in. You get an inner product with a 0 in to the left, a 0 in to the right. You get m powers of a in, and you get n powers of a dagger in, and then you have to use the commutation relations repeatedly, inductively, to find out what that inner product is. And you will find that if n is not equal to m, then the inner product is zero. Those vectors are orthogonal to each other. In fact, it's sort of easy to see that that has to come out zero, because if the number of a daggers is not matching the number of a's, you will have either an a left, when you use the commutation relations, you will either have an a left over always to act to the right, or you have an a dagger left over act to the left, and that just kills it. But if you have the same number of a daggers and a's, then there's going to be a finite contribution, which is actually factorial, and so this 1 over squared factorial will make the norm come out right. But you have to do it to see how it plays out. The proposition goes further. Those vectors, the so-defined vectors, the vectors obtained by repeatedly applying the so-called erasing operator a dagger onto the vector 0, the ground state, these vectors are all eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian, and their energies, the eigenvalues En, their energies are given by omega n plus 1/2. In other words, we are running in this way through all of the excited states of the harmonic oscillator. See how neat and clean all of this went? We didn't have to solve for the eigenfunctions of the harmonic oscillator differential equation. No need for Hermite functions and Hermite polynomials. We get the energy, the energies of the harmonic oscillator directly in this way. And then by the spectral theorem, that requires quite a bit of functional analysis, one can prove that this is all there is, and this will span the Hilbert space. It's a complete orthonormal eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian, and it will span the Hilbert space. Okay, so let me summarize a few points regarding the choice of bases at early times before the force acts. Remember, the Hamiltonian is constant as long as the force hasn't started acting, and therefore it has just one and the same eigenbasis at all early times. Namely, this is the eigenbasis, consisting of the ground state and the nth excited states of the harmonic oscillator. And we can expand every arbitrary vector in the Hilbert space, let's call it gamma, in this basis. So we could work with the position eigenbasis of the harmonic oscillator. We could work with the in the momentum eigenbasis for the harmonic oscillator, in which case we would have to care about Hermite polynomials, Hermite functions, and all their various complicated properties. But we don't have to. We have a basis of the Hilbert space spanned by the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian, and every vector in the Hilbert space is some linear combination of these basis vectors with some coefficients gamma n. So for example, if the harmonic oscillator is in a state whose position wave function looks like this, some sort of complicated curve, square integrable function of space, of the x-coordinate, well, then the harmonic oscillator is in some state which we may call gamma. Okay? The state gamma has a position wave function like this. Then there exist coefficients gamma n such that gamma can be written in this way, because it's just a vector in the Hilbert space, and every vector in the Hilbert space has an expansion like this. The expansion coefficients are given by the inner product between the position wave function of gamma and the position wave function of the nth excited state of the harmonic oscillator. So if you want to know what the gamma n is, you have to integrate the position wave function of the state gamma, position wave function of it, multiply it with the nth excited state's position wave function, some Hermite function, integrate that over, that is going to be the gamma n. Anyway, we won't bother doing this. I'm just saying that we can express everything about the theory in any basis we choose, including this one, and that will be a convenient one. Mm-hmm.
Could
Real
no, polynomials are not. But remember, the eigenfunctions of the harmonic oscillator are not Hamming polynomials, but Hamming functions. And Hamming functions are given by the Hamming polynomials times the Gaussian. And the Gaussian makes the whole thing square integrable. But good question, thanks. Okay, so for example, the state in which our quantum system is in could be the state gamma, which is, let's say, the fifth excited state of the harmonic oscillator. If so, then the system will always stay in that state, at least for early times, right? No, we work in the Heisenberg picture. It will always stay in that state, right? Whatever the state is of the system at early times, it will be the same state later on. It could also be the state with a wave function like this, right? Whatever state you prepare the system in at early times, it's always going to be that state. As a vector in the Hilbert space, it will be nailed in place. It cannot change. It's one vector in the Hilbert space. However, if the vector is, let's say, at early times, the fifth excited state of the Hamiltonian, there is no guarantee that this very same vector later on still is the fifth excited state of the Hamiltonian. It's still the same vector in the Hilbert space, of course. It's frozen in place because it's work in the Heisenberg picture. But the Hamilton operator is time dependent. Therefore, what vector is its fifth eigenstate changes over time because the operator changes over time. Therefore, you have to get used to the idea that in the Heisenberg picture, the state is frozen in time and its meaning changes because the observables against which the state acquires meaning, the observables are time dependent. Okay, so even though we may prepare a system in the fifth excited state or, as we more often will do, in the ground state of the early Hamiltonian, at late times, this very same state as a vector in the Hilbert space ceases to be an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian in general. And if the Hamiltonian is that of a harmonic oscillator, remember that excitations of a harmonic oscillator, if that harmonic oscillator is an oscillator of a wave, of a quantum field, then the excitations mean the presence of particles. So if we find that when we prepare the system in the ground state of the early harmonic oscillator, that very same state later on is no longer the ground state of the harmonic oscillator because the Hamiltonian has changed, then we will be able to deduce that particles have been produced. Now, let's look at the late period after the force has ceased to act. So remember that while the force is acting, the Hamiltonian is time dependent. But after the force is finished with acting, the Hamiltonian is no longer time dependent. The Hamiltonian then is, but this much is always true. The Hamiltonian can always be written in this way. Remember, this is why we chose the A variable the way we did, so that the Hamiltonian can be written in this simple way. When the force has finished acting, that the J term is absent, so this term goes away. But also, it simplifies further when the force has stopped acting, because when the force has stopped acting, then A of t can be expressed simply in terms of A out, right? At late times, A of t is simply A out times the phase factor. Therefore, the Hamiltonian becomes omega times, this thing is A dagger of t becomes A dagger out times the phase factor, and this becomes A out times the phase factor. The two phase factors have opposite signs, so they go away. The plus 1/2 is carried forward. And what we see is that the Hamiltonian at late times, again, no longer time dependent. It's a fixed operator, which is very nice. If we calculate its eigenbasis, the eigenbasis is the same at all later times. Also, remember that A out is nothing mysterious. A out is simply given by, where is it? Ah, here it is. A out is A in plus J naught. J naught being that integral over what the force did multiplied with the Fourier factor. So at late times, the Hamiltonian is constant again, expressed in this way. Later, we will relate A out to A in this way and relate the two bases. The Fock basis that we just constructed for early times, and now the Fock basis that we construct for the later time. How do we construct the Fock basis at late times? Well, let us look at the operator A out. The operator A out has the same commutation relations with A dagger out as did the A in. And the way that the Hamiltonian is looks like it's just exactly the same thing. So it's just exactly the same construction, the same Fock construction as we did before. Only now it's applied to A out. So again, we start by determining a vector that we will call 0 out, which is eigenvector to A out with eigenvalue 0. And once we identified it, we normalize it to 1. And then we construct lots of more vectors by applying a dagger out onto this with arbitrary powers, suitable normalization factor, and we get in this way an orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space again. It's no better or worse than the Hilbert space basis that we had constructed 10 minutes ago. You can use any basis anytime. It's just that this basis will be convenient to use at late time because it's the eigenbasis to the Hamiltonian at late time. No wonder that the Hamiltonian at late time has the same spectrum, the same behavior as the Hamiltonian at earlier time, because the frequency hasn't overall changed. So we will get the same energy eigenvalues, however, not the same energy eigenvectors, right? Because this is definitely the A out is a different operator than the A was, than the A in was, right? Because of this. So what we will find is that the eigenbasis that we generate in this way, the Fock basis for late times, is by no means the same as the Fock basis at early times. It will be different because the A out is different from the A in. The eigenvectors are going to be different. Now, for this simple scenario now, our training exercise here, let's study the before and after. Let's study what was the motion before the force acted. Probably nothing, if we assume that the harmonic oscillator started out in its ground state. And then we find out, how does it oscillate after the force is done? Then let's ask, how about resonance? How do we see that it makes a difference to drive it the harmonic oscillator at a particular frequency? What's the best J? What happens to the energy expectation? How much energy are we pumping into the system by driving it? The energy eigenstate. If we start out with a lowest energy state and then we drive with the force, do we get excited states? Do we get what would be in quantum field theory particle creation? Let's go through those points A, B, C, D. In the case where the quantum field starts out in the vacuum. You know, just like before black hole forms or before the inflationary period in the early universe. So let's consider the situation where the quantum field starts out in the state 0 in, and we call that state gamma. Remember, the quantum field, because we work in the Heisenberg picture, is always going to be in that state, no matter what the force does. It's only the operators that evolve in time. So now let's calculate the motion. What is the expectation value of the position at early times, before the force acts? Well, the expectation value of the position is Q bar, is given in this way. We take the state of the system, and we take the operator, the position operator at early times. And the state gamma is really the state zero in. And Q hat of t can be expressed as the self-adjoint part of A in this way. So for early time, we have that A dagger of t is simply A in times the phase factor, and A of t is A in times this phase factor, and that is vanishing. Why? Well, because we have A acting on 0 in, but 0 in is eigenvector to eigenvalue 0 of A in. And by the same argument, A dagger in acting to the left is really the same as A in acting on 0 in to the right. It's just the Brer version of this ket. So that term acting on this here is also vanishing. You can also see it differently. Act with A dagger in on that. What do you get? The first excited state, 1 in. But 1 in is orthogonal to 0 in. So you get a 0 this way. OK, so what we find is that the position expectation value is 0. If the harmonic oscillator is in its ground state, the position expectation value is 0. There's a fluctuation, all right, but the expectation value, the average position, is 0, as we would have expected. Now, for later times, what do we get? Well, at late times, the state of the system is still gamma because we're in a Heisenberg picture. The operator, the position operator, however, will have evolved in time. According to this, it's still the real part of A of t. And A of t at late times, after the force has finished acting, is given by A out times the phase factor, and here's the Hermitian conjugate of that. So can we conclude in the same way that we get a zero just because we have an A acting on that? No, we cannot. Because we don't know how A out is acting on 0 in. We know how A in is acting on that by annihilation, but we don't know a priori how A out is acting on this. So what we have to do is we have to write A out in terms of A in. Okay, let's do that. Let's write A out in terms of A in. A out is A in plus J naught. And over here, A dagger out is A in dagger plus J naught star. Now we are in much better shape because we know how A in is going to act on that. This is eigenvector, this is eigenvector to eigenvalue 0 of that, so this term goes away. Same argument, this term acting on that goes away. So we are left with still two terms, J naught star here and the J naught term. And they are this. Okay, so now apparently the position expectation value is a function of time that's not zero in general. It looks complex, but it's not, because this is just a complex conjugate of that. You can also write it in terms of the sign. And what we see here is that at late times, you know, this is the calculation for late times. At late times, the position expectation value, Q bar of t, oscillates with the frequency omega. You can read it here or there. Again, what we would have expected. The harmonic oscillator started in its ground state. Then we shook it for a while with the driving force. And then the driving force ceases. And the harmonic oscillator hasn't quite recovered from the shaking. It's still shaking. At what frequency? Well, the harmonic oscillator knows no better. It can only do omega. So it will oscillate at the frequency omega. And the amplitude of the oscillation is proportional to J naught. Okay. Now let's look at resonance. The amplitude of the excited motion of the oscillator is determined by J naught, as we just said. The larger J naught is, the larger is going to be the oscillation, right? If J naught is 0, the position expectation would be 0. Now, we expect intuitively that the driving force J of t is most efficient at leaving behind an oscillating oscillator if the driving force itself was oscillating roughly at the oscillator's natural frequency, omega. And that's indeed the case. Let us remember what J naught is. The constant J naught was the integral from 0 to capital T, so the period of action of the driving force. And we integrate the driving force with this Fourier factor here. So therefore, the more of the frequency omega is in J of t over that interval, the larger is J naught, and therefore the larger is the amplitude with which the harmonic oscillator oscillates after the force is over. Now let's look at the energy expectation before and after. At early times, we have that the energy expectation value is calculated this way. You know, the state of the system is gamma, and remember, that is also zero in. We prepared the system in the zero in state, in the ground state of the early Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian at early times can be written in this way. This term here goes away because A acts on zero in. So we are just left with the term omega half. That's h bar omega half, the ground state energy of the harmonic oscillator. No surprise here. We prepared the system in the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, and the energy expectation value is the ground state energy of the harmonic oscillator. Now, at late times, after the force has finished acting, let's recalculate. Energy expectation value is again written in this way. The state of the system is still gamma because it's the Heisenberg picture, but the Hamiltonian will have changed in time. And the Hamiltonian at late times, remember, can be written as omega A dagger A out, A out plus plus 1/2. And again, can't immediately tell what the outcome is because we can't immediately tell how A out is acting on zero in. It's not annihilating it. It's A in which is annihilating zero in, but not A out. But again, easily fixed. We simply express A out in terms of A in. It's after all simply A in plus J naught. So we just transcribe that with A dagger out replaced by A dagger in plus J naught star, and this one similarly replaced. And now we see that this term, the A in, is going away because it acts on that. And similarly, this term acts to the left and will go away. We are, however, still keeping this term, and that product also survives. So the energy expectation value at late times is given by this. So these are just numbers multiplying the identity operator. And this is a normalized vector. So you know we can pull this thing out as a number, and then we have 0 in, the length of that vector is 1, it's normalized. So overall, the energy expectation value as a function of time for late times is given by this. And you see that, in general, the harmonic oscillator will have picked up energy. It's no longer having simply the energy 1/2 h bar omega. No, no, no. If the force has acted, this is the net effect of the force. It will have increased the amplitude, as we saw earlier, in a linear fashion, proportionally to J naught, but it will have increased the energy in a quadratic fashion, quadratically, I mean, proportional to J naught modulus squared. And again, the energy will be increased the more, well, the larger J naught, but J naught is the larger, the closer the driving was to the resonance frequency. But of course, if the driving is only for a very short period of time, then you don't have to match the resonance frequency so well, because then by the time frequency uncertainty principle, you can still pick up quite a bit of contribution, which is mathematically the statement that two plane waves of different frequencies, when integrated over the real line, I mean, you multiply them and integrate the product over the real line, you will find zero if they have different frequencies, which is to say that the plane waves of two different frequencies are orthogonal vectors in Hilbert space. But if you take two plane waves, multiply them, and integrate them over only a finite interval, that's not going to be zero then. And in fact, you get a sine omega over omega, sine delta omega over delta omega behavior. Instead of having a Dirac delta that describes the inner product of two plane waves of different frequencies, Dirac delta with respect to the frequencies, peaking only when the frequencies are identical, you get the so-called sinc function for the resonance curve. Minor point. Now, in quantum field theory, for example, when it is electrical current which drives the electromagnetic field, for example, in an antenna, then the closer the mode frequency is to the frequency of the current, the more the mode gets excited. Now, some implications. We started out with the system in the ground state of the harmonic oscillator of early time. Then at late times, the energy is elevated, which means that while the state of the system is still gamma, still the same vector in the Hilbert space, and therefore it still is zero in, this state can no longer have the interpretation as the ground state of the harmonic oscillator at late times. The state zero out must be different from this state, clearly, because we know that this state has an energy expectation value that's way above 1/2 h bar omega. So it can't be zero out. So the ground state zero out of the harmonic oscillator at late times, after this operator has evolved in time, the ground state of that Hamiltonian would have to have ground state energy 1/2 h bar omega, because it's just a regular harmonic oscillator again, with the same old frequency omega, and no driving force attached to it. So its ground state energy is 1/2 h bar omega. It's just that the zero out vector can no longer be the zero in vector. It's just not the zero in vector. Never been, never will be. And indeed, when we take the A out vector and apply it to our state of the system gamma, then we find that it's not annihilated. Remember that the state that the system is prepared in was zero in, which is the vector that's annihilated by A in. So gamma is annihilated by A in, but it's not annihilated by A out, because if you apply A out to gamma, which is to say you apply A out to zero in, then you're really applying A in plus J naught to zero in. And we see that this thing annihilates that, but we are left with J naught, which is, we can conclude here that gamma, which is also zero in, is not annihilated by A out. It's not eigenvector with eigenvalue zero. It is eigenvector with eigenvalue J naught. So what we see is that at late times, the state that used to be the ground state of the Hamiltonian, and therefore used to be eigenvector with eigenvalue zero of the vector A, is at late times still an eigenvector to the annihilation operator that we use later on, but with different eigenvalue. Eigenvalue J naught, where J naught is a complex number. This is the first occurrence of a phenomenon that we will see throughout this course, namely that not only are we interested in the vectors which are annihilated by A, which are the ground state vectors of harmonic oscillators, we will also be interested in states which are eigenvectors to annihilation operators with some complex eigenvalues. By the way, why can they be complex? Normally, eigenvalues have to be real, right?
A isn't self-adjoint.
If it were, A would be equal to A dagger, which it isn't, right? And so indeed, it can have complex eigenvalues, and it does. So what we see is that states will be relevant in our studies that are eigenvectors to annihilation operators, annihilation and creation operators are the same thing as lowering and raising operators. In quantum field theory, they're called creation and annihilation operators because they create and annihilate particles in that interpretation. Excitations of harmonic oscillators are particles. And in the case of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, we would call them ladder operators or raising and lowering operators. In any case, what we see here is the need to study eigenvectors of the annihilation operators with complex eigenvalues. Now, let's look at it. What kind of state is gamma at late times? What kind of state is that? It's an eigenvector to A, complex eigenvalues. Now, since gamma is an eigenvalue of a lowering operator with some it's an eigenvector with some complex eigenvalue, it is what is called a coherent state. Coherent states will come up a lot. Coherent states are, by definition, states which are eigenstates to an annihilation operator. And they have fascinating properties. Among them is the explanation for why electromagnetic fields appear classical to us. Right? Electromagnetic fields are made out of photons. But when have you last seen a photon? It's a very good approximation to say that electromagnetic fields are classical. Why? Now we will find out why that is. So coherent states saturate the uncertainty principle. That's an amazing property of those coherent states, of eigenvectors to the A operator. If psi is a coherent state, then the product of the uncertainties in Q and P is h bar half. It is exactly h bar half, which is to say that the product of the uncertainties is as small as it can be, which means that the state psi is almost classical. The quantum system tries its best to look classical because the quantum fluctuations in Q and the quantum fluctuations in P are as small as it gets. Fluctuations are minimized. Now, these states, therefore, come closest to having definite values for Q and P. You see, we would like to be able to write that the Q position operator on psi is eigenvalue or position expectation value times psi, and the momentum operator acting on psi is momentum eigenvalue or momentum expectation value on psi. We can't have that. We can't have a state psi which is simultaneously eigenvector to Q and to P. There are no states in the quantum theory that are eigenvectors to canonically conjugate pairs of observables. But these coherent states get damn close to it. If we write that this is expectation value times psi, can't be eigenvalue, but expectation value, and P is, expectation value of P times psi, then these equations can be approximately right, and the uncertainties, the fluctuations around the expectation value can be small, as small as possible. That's what the coherent states achieve. And what we have found implicitly in our explicitly in our calculations is that when a harmonic oscillator, when a quantum harmonic oscillator, and that's a key message of today's lecture, when a quantum harmonic oscillator starts in the ground state and then is shaken by external driving forces, and it doesn't matter what exactly the driving force does, it could be subtle or it could be kicking the harmonic oscillator, doesn't matter what it does. After the harmonic, after the driving force is finished with its job, the quantum system is going to be in a coherent state. Right? What that means for an antenna is that no matter what kind of wild currents you send around in your antenna, if before all the modes of the quantum field of electromagnetism were in a ground state, after the antenna is done with its job, the quantum field of the electromagnetic field is the quantum electromagnetic field is going to be in a coherent state. Each one of its modes is a harmonic oscillator that has been driven. It's going to be in a coherent state. Okay. That's why the electromagnetic field generally looks classical to us. It tries its best to do it, right? So no matter how you generate it, as long as you generate electromagnetic waves in a driving way, you're going to put it in a coherent state, which is having as little fluctuations as possible. Therefore, if the amplitude of the electromagnetic field is significant, then the amplitude ratio of fluctuations over amplitude is small, and you don't see quantum behavior of the electromagnetic field. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's not, then you simply have to act with another A dagger in. For example, if it's a first excited state on the out state, we will work it out exactly, actually, not today, but later on, how exactly you map the in all the vectors of the in basis into the vectors of the out basis. No, it's not. Well, it's going to be what is called a Gaussian state, which is a generalization of it. If you start with a Gaussian state, you end up with a Gaussian state. That's the statement. Yep.
So the new ground state now, after t, is going to be an eigenstate with a real eigenvalue. That's the only one which will have a real eigenvalue for a out.
No, you never get a real eigenvalue for A. It's always complex eigenvalues.
What would the ground state in the new after T?
Sorry?
The ground state.
Yes.
After T.
Oh, I see. You mean, well, okay, so the ground state at late times is eigenvector to eigenvalue 0 of A out. Yeah. That's correct. Yes.
There's the only one which has a real eigenvalue in that sense. Of 0.
Yes, yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's what I just said here. Now, there are further implications that are really not that necessary for what we do in this course eventually, you know, quantum field theory and cosmology. But you might still find it interesting as it has implications for the interpretation of quantum mechanics. In a course on quantum mechanics, you've probably heard something like this. You have the Schrödinger equation. It describes the evolution of an electron. And it will evolve unitarily according to the Schrödinger equation until a measurement takes place. Then the wave function collapses. And then again, the Schrödinger equation, da, da, da. Okay? That's probably what you heard. Or let me paraphrase that. If an electron moves along and then interacts with another system, then its wave function collapses because that other system has learned something about the electron, has collided with it, learned something about it, like where it was or how fast it was. And so after that interaction, the electron's wave function ought to have collapsed. I'm just saying that the measurement process is an interaction. But now, let us look at the situation of an electron in the electromagnetic field. For example, the electron travels along, and then it encounters a strong magnetic field, so that it actually goes in circles now around the magnetic field line. Or it might encounter a strong electrostatic field, in which case it might be captured, like by a proton, and it goes in a circle around the proton now. So certainly, the interaction between the electron and that magnetic field or that electrostatic field is strong. Strong interaction, right? Why the hell is the electron's wave function not decohering then? See, we have the interaction between two quantum systems. There's the electron, and then there's the electromagnetic field. They interact with each other. Why is this not a measurement? Why is this not decohering the electron? Why is its wave function not collapsing? Shouldn't it? It has a very strong interaction with another quantum system. So strong that it goes in circles now. Or in other words, why is it legal to write a magnetic field into the Schrödinger equation, a classical magnetic field into the Schrödinger equation, or a classical electrostatic field like a Coulomb potential in the Schrödinger equation? Because what it implies is that the electron is going to strongly interact with that field. But if it has a strong interaction, it should be just like interacting with the environment. Wave function collapse. Why is it not collapsing? Why is that legal? Right? Let's go through the math of why that is legal. It has to do with coherent states again, with stuff trying to look as classical as possible. No need to read this, I told you just now. Okay, so here's how it works. Consider the quantum systems, two of them, consisting of the quantum system of the electron and the quantum system of the electromagnetic field. Then on a schematic level, without writing out all the details, the total Hamiltonian of this combined system of the electron, one lonely electron soldier moving along, and the electromagnetic field, the total Hamiltonian looks like this. We have the Hamiltonian of the electromagnetic field, which looks a bit like our Klein-Gordon Hamiltonian, just a bit more decorated with indices and stuff. So we have the Hamiltonian of the electromagnetic field. We have the Hamiltonian of our electron, the usual Hamiltonian, p squared over 2m, or minus Laplacian over 2m. And then we have an interaction Hamiltonian that couples the two, because the electron has a charge. It couples to the electromagnetic field. And the interaction Hamiltonian, very schematically, between an electron and the electromagnetic field could look, for example, like this. You have a p vector describing the current of the electron, which is coupling to the magnetic field. Right? That should be non-trivial index structure, but just to get the structure, the overall structure of it. Right? There's an operator that acts on the Hilbert space of the electron, and there's an operator that acts on the Hilbert space of the electromagnetic field. Both are operators. They need to be hats on that. We want to understand why it is legal to drop that hat, to make this look classical. Right? Because if we can do that, if we can drop the hat there, then what do we have? Well, then we have the Hamiltonian of the electron. Then we have the interaction Hamiltonian, which has only an operator for the electron in it, and a classical number here. And this thing you can forget because it doesn't couple anymore. The two Hilbert spaces are a tensor product of each other, and the Hamiltonian doesn't mix the two. So how come we can do this? How come we can drop that? Initially, we cannot, for sure. Now, let's assume that the initial state of the total system, our lonely electron soldier and the electromagnetic field, let's assume that the total system is the tensor product between a state of the electron and the state of the electromagnetic field. The only assumption here is that they're not entangled. We can write it as a tensor product of two states. If they're independently prepared, they're not entangled. Some state of the electron moving along like this, and some state of the electromagnetic field. We have a few photons flying around, for example. Or none of them, whatever. Your choice. Then, in general, the time evolution operator in the total system of the electron here and the quantum field everywhere, the time evolution operator is given by integrating the equation of motion for the time evolution operator, e to the power of minus it h total. Total Hamiltonian. This time evolution operator acts on the tensor product of the both Hilbert spaces, the electron and the quantum field, quantum electromagnetic field. So then in the Schrödinger picture, if we use that for a moment, in the Schrödinger picture then, the time evolution of the state, you know, this one, time evolution of this initial state is given by that equation here. Time evolved state is given by the time evolution operator, where we have e to the power minus it, Hamiltonian of the field, Hamiltonian of the electron, and the interaction Hamiltonian, which is p hat and b hat, an operator that acts on the Hilbert space of the electron, and an operator that acts on the Hilbert space of the field. And this thing acts on that state, where this piece is acting non-trivially only on that. This piece, electron Hamiltonian, acts non-trivially only on this and acts as the identity over there. But this guy is acting non-trivially both on the electron's Hilbert space and non-trivially on the field's Hilbert space. And that means that after time has passed, after some time has passed and the electron and the field have had some interaction, for example, the electron is caught into a magnetic field and starts orbiting or whatever, or yeah, something like this, what you have is that this state psi of t can no longer be written simply as the tensor product of a vector in the Hilbert space of the electron and a vector in the Hilbert space of the quantum field. Instead, it will be a complicated linear combination of such tensor products. In other words, it will be an entangled state. Okay, and the culprit that entangles the two is this thing. Because if you forget about those, even if they were absent, it would be true that exponentiating this operator and applying it to that, it's going to mix this thing. So therefore, in general, what will happen is that the electron's wave function will decohere. It is as if a measurement took place. I'm not sure if you are all familiar with this, but it's totally important to understand quantum mechanics. When you have, as is the case here, two quantum systems that start out unentangled, then they have an interaction, and then they move apart again, then they will in general be entangled. And if you look at just what happened to one of the two systems, and you find something very different from what you find, mathematically speaking, from what you find when you look at both systems. If you look at both systems, as we just did, you find that there's a unitary time evolution according to the total Hamiltonian. No measurement took place. But if you trace over one of the two systems, and you follow the evolution of the other, then you find it started out in a pure state. And then as the interaction happened, that pure state evolved into a mixed state. And then as the interaction ended, you know, it's still in a mixed state. So what you see here is that if you take such a composite system in total unitary time evolution, but if you trace over one system, then the other system will evolve generally from a pure state into a mixed state. That is the measurement process calculated through quantum mechanically. The collapse of the wave function is calculated dynamically in this way. You can always take the collapse of the wave function and look at a bigger system which has the measurement apparatus as part of it, and the whole evolution is unitary. You can calculate this through using the total Hamiltonian, and then by tracing over the measurement apparatus, you can calculate how, during the interaction in a continuous fashion, a pure state turns into a mixed state. And if you have not done that calculation yet, please do it. It's not the subject of this course, but it's fascinating stuff. And what you find there is that if and only if the two systems get entangled in the process of interacting, it will count as a measurement in the sense that if you look at one system only, it will evolve from a pure state into a mixed state. If, however, the interaction is such that they may be interacting, even interacting strongly, but such that they don't get entangled, then pure states go into pure states, even though there's interaction. So the subtle point about this, and when you study quantum information theory, you will do all these calculations all the time, because for quantum computers, this is totally important, you know, decoherence and so on. When you study that, you will find that as I said, if and only if there's entanglement created, does a pure state evolve into a mixed state, then you have a measurement. So the upshot of all of this is that interaction is not equal measurement. you can have strong interactions without measurements taking place. This is what happens when you describe the when you take the Schrödinger equation and you put in a magnetic field, classical magnetic field, or a classical Coulomb potential. It's a strong interaction between the electron and the electromagnetic field, but it's not an entangling interaction. And why? The reason is that the electromagnetic field is generally in a coherent state. And because the electromagnetic field is in a coherent state, it tries its best not to fluctuate too much. Okay? And as I will show you now, that exactly means that it's not entangling. That the interaction is not entangling. So here we go. This is how the entangling happens. This term will, when exponentiated, you know, produces 1 plus 1 power of this plus 2 powers of this, etc. It will produce a complicated linear combination of vectors in this Hilbert space, vectors in that Hilbert space, and so on. So the whole thing ends up entangled. However, what if when B hat acts on the electromagnetic field, it produces an eigenstate or almost an eigenstate, as is the case with the coherent state? What if this thing, when acting on that, produces almost an eigenstate? So what if when B hat acting on the electromagnetic field state, basically the expectation value, like an eigenvalue, the expectation value times the electromagnetic field, if this is a good approximation, in the sense that the fluctuations are small compared to the expectation value, the variance is small compared to the expectation value. What then happens is that we can, in a good approximation, replace this thing by the number, by the expectation value. But then, once we can do that, and we can do that if the electromagnetic field is in a coherent state, if we can do that, well, then the total Hamiltonian has no longer any entangling power, because this Hamiltonian acts non-trivially only on the field. This Hamiltonian acts non-trivially only on the electron's Hilbert space. And this one also acts non-trivially only on the electron's Hilbert space. Because saying that B hat, the operator, is replaced by expectation value B times the identity operator means it's acting trivially on the Hilbert space of the electromagnetic field. So it has no longer entangling power, and therefore the electron no longer decoheres when it interacts with an electromagnetic field, even when it does so strongly. All right, I think, yep, that's, I just told you that. Okay, that's it for today.